I don't know about you, but my assessment of myself varies a great deal. One day I'm smart and confident and feel like I can conquer the world. However, there are other days when I know I'm not good enough and can't possibly handle the problem in front of me. Well, I guess consistency isn't my long suit. One of the times that I was really unsure of myself was when I was newly elected president of this church. I was on the way to the board retreat, my first meeting in my new role. I was scared to death, and I was sure I was going to mess up big time. The whole way in the car, I loudly sang, "I Have Confidence" from The Sound of Music. The lyrics are something like, "I have confidence in sunshine, I have confidence in rain," and it goes on and on. "You'll have to agree, I have confidence in me." Now, I'm not a great singer, that's not new, but that doesn't matter. The song helped me feel better and more sure of myself about the retreat. I did okay, and the board got off to a good start. There are times, though, that my cockiness takes over. Once I wrote a letter to 1,400 school districts. It included the number for CalPERS as 800 CalPERS. After being reviewed by at least two or three people, and that's because I can't spell worth beans, we sent it out. The good news is lots of districts called the number. The bad news is the CalPERS number is 888 CalPERS. The man who had the 800 number was understandably a little angry. That was a fun conversation. I quickly apologized and said that we'd correct it right away. I also called CalPERS staff to let them know what had happened and that it was my fault. I drafted a new letter, including an apology and the right phone number this time, and took it to the boss when I confessed. I had just assumed the number was 800 and never even checked. I'm lucky because it was sloppy and it was an embarrassment, but didn't cost too much to correct, and no one got hurt really badly. Nice. But boy, did I learn some lessons. The obvious one is to check contact information carefully. The other was the realization that I need to be less cocky and more aware of my tendency to jump right in knowing or assuming, that's the big word, assuming I know what I'm doing. One of the ways I remind myself about that issue is to repeat the phrase, "Buzz Lightyear, Space Ranger." Well, really a toy space ranger. That translates to, "Ginny, get a grip and come back to Earth. Don't just assume you know the answer. Do some research." It works almost as well as checking my socks. "What?" you say? About 10 years ago, I was in a group and all agreed that I took myself far too seriously. I can be horribly earnest, you know. The advice was to lighten up, and the group suggested I do something symbolic, like paint my toenails green. I did, but you know, it only works in warm weather. I don't see my toenails when I'm wearing shoes and socks. So I decided to wear silly socks. Somehow, even though I was the manager in the business suit, I had to relax when I looked down and saw butterflies and ladybugs on my socks. Or for that matter, looking down and seeing hedgehogs with Santa hats on my socks helps me relax today.
Thank you. This reading is the words of Pema Chodron. She is an American Buddhist nun who studies in the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism. And this is from Chodron's book, Start Where You Are. No matter what the teachings are, the point at which they all agree is to let go of holding on to yourself. That's the way of becoming at home in your world. That is not to say that ego is sin. Ego is not sin. Ego is not something that you get rid of. Ego is something that you come to know, something that you befriend by neither acting out nor repressing all the feelings that you feel. Whether we are talking about the painful international situation or our painful domestic situation, the pain is a result of what's called ego clinging, of wanting things to work out on our own terms, or wanting me victorious. Ego is like a room of your own, a room with a view, with the temperature and smells and the music you like. You want it your own way. But the more you think that way, the more you try to get life to come out so that it will always suit you, the more your fear of other people and of what's outside your room will grow. Rather than becoming more relaxed, you start pulling down the shades and locking the door. When you do go out, you find the experience more and more unsettling, disagreeable. You become touchier, more fearful, more irritable than ever. The more you just try to get it your way, the less you feel at home. To begin to develop compassion for yourself and others, you have to unlock the door. You don't open it yet because you have to work with your fear that somebody you don't like might come in the door. Then as you begin to relax and befriend those feelings, you begin to open it. Sure enough, in come the music and the smells that you don't like. Sure enough, someone puts a foot in and tells you that you should be a different religion or should vote for someone you don't like or give money that you don't want to give. Now you begin to relate with those feelings. You develop some compassion. You relate to what begins to happen when you are not protecting yourself so much. Then gradually you become more curious than afraid. Just open the door more and more, and at some point you'll feel capable of inviting all sentient beings as your guests. It helps to realize that the Nelson Mandelas and Mother Teresas of the world also know how it feels to be in a small room with the windows and doors closed. They also know anger and jealousy and loneliness. They are people who have made friends with themselves and therefore made friends with the world. They are people who develop the bravery to be able to relate to the shaky, tender, fearful feelings in their own hearts, and therefore they are no longer afraid of those feelings when they are triggered by the outside world.
This is a story from the Gesta Romanorum, a compilation of medieval morality tales. It is quoted in the book Spirituality of Imperfection by Ernest Kurtz and Catherine Ketchum. There was a queen who dishonored herself with a servant and bore him a son. This son, on arriving at years of maturity, practiced every description of wickedness and conducted himself with the greatest of insolence toward the prince, his reputed father. The prince, unable to account for such perversion of mind, interrogated the mother as to the legitimacy of her child, and finding by her reluctant confession that he was not his son. Though loath to deprive him of his kingdom, the prince ordained that the young man's dress for the time should come to be of different textures and colors, one side to be composed of ordinary material and the other of the most valuable. Then, when he looked upon the baser portion, his pride might be abated and the vicious propensities to which he had indulged relinquished. On the other hand, when he surveyed the more gorgeous part, his hopes might be raised and his spirit animated to goodness. By this judicious device, he became remarkable for humility and ever after abandoned his dishonest life.
So every third Sunday of the month, we have a class called Exploring Unitarian Universalism, and there's four rotating topics. One of the topics is on UU principles. And I want to put a plug in, it's next Sunday. So regular members, new people, please come and join us the third Sunday at 9:30 in the FOS classroom. But when we talk about principles at our exploring class, I like to tell folks about how the first and the seventh principle are really what to be considered our pillar principles. So now there's going to be a quiz. What's the first principle? Yes. What's the seventh principle? Respect for the... Yeah, very good. That was the shortcut version. Very, very good. So these are the pillar principles because they're really about how to be in the world. The principles in between are more about things that we vision and dream for, justice, equity, world peace, but... 1 and 7 are really about how we are in the world, how we feel about ourselves, how we treat others, and how we engage in commitment to this interdependent web that we are all a part. I want to use these two principles to frame my sermon today, talking about ego and humility and hubris. So let's start with the definition of ego. You know I love to start with definitions, so I know we're at least on the same page. The definition I found says that ego is the part of the mind that mediates between the conscious and the unconscious and is responsible for reality testing and a sense of personal identity. Ego is responsible for reality testing and a sense of personal identity. So what do we mean when we talk about a healthy ego? I find it kind of interesting that we actually kind of deride the idea. People go, whoa, she's got a healthy ego, right? We almost think the idea of having a healthy ego is an inflated ego. It's not necessarily a compliment to say someone has a healthy ego, unless perhaps you're a Buddhist. Because Buddhism, so much of it is really about cultivating and managing your ego. The reading that Roger shared from Pema Chodron talks about stepping out of the outside of this room of your ego, the room where everything is just the way you want it to be, learning how to navigate the challenges in the world. So what does ego have to do with the interdependent web, this seventh principle of ours? By cultivating a healthy ego, it means you're lessening the damage that you're doing in the world. Your health, your ego strength, your ability to navigate the buffers of the world helps you be a better and more loving person and tend to this web, take care of this interdependent web. So let's explore this a little bit deeper. First of all, I have to correct the sermon title. We write these titles, you know, several weeks before they actually occur. And I've titled this as From Hubris to Humility. But really, the correct title should be From Hubris to Self-Debasement with Humility Dead Set in the Middle. That is the continuum. The continuum is not from hubris to humility, because there's something on the other side of humility. Ego health, ego strength is this balancing act between the two aspects, balancing between hubris and self-debasement, between thinking you're everything and thinking that you're nothing. The fulcrum, the point of intersection, the point of connection and movement is humility. The Swedish diplomat Dag Hammarskjöld said that humility is just as much the opposite of self-debasement as it is self-exaltation. To be humble is not to make comparisons. To be humble is not to make comparisons. It's to be at home in that center fulcrum. So I was trying to think of an example for this balancing act that I wanted to share with you. And the perfect example is something in my life now, which is Tai Chi. And thank you, John McMillan, for sharing your Tai Chi school with me. I've been studying Tai Chi for about 10 months now. And anytime you start something new, it's totally a lesson in humility. But in particular, in my private lesson, my instructor is very circumspect. If he says, "That was fine," I'm like, "Yeah!" Because he's very, very careful about what he says to me. So he helps me with that ego management aspect and challenges me with finding a place to let new things into my life. But really, the part that I really wanted to share with you is the example of what happens in my class. So I'm going to take you to the group Tai Chi class. I'm here, and there's a person here, there's a person here. There's people in the front row, and the instructor's in front, and then there's people in the back. So we begin our practice together. And here I am, and he says, "Begin." So I start out, and I'm like, "Oh, man, I'm totally going to nail this. I am so smooth. Look at me. I am going to be so great at this. Oh, that guy's posture is so much better than mine. Oh, my gosh. Wow, huh. Oh, my God, that person hardly knows what they're doing. My God, I am so much better than they are. Wow. Oh, no, I don't know what the next thing is I'm supposed to do. Oh, shoot, I blew it. Oh, no. Okay, you get the idea. Did you see that balancing act? So humility is that moment where you're just in it. You're just doing it. You're just being present with it. You're not, "I'm bad, I'm good, they're bad, they're good." Humility is not about making comparisons. It's just being present, present in that moment. So let's talk a little bit about the two sides of this balancing act, the hubris side. Hubris. Hubris is that full-on sense of everything should be exactly the way you think it should be. And everyone who doesn't think that is the problem. Now, we certainly know about hubris in our world today. I'm sure you all have a vision in your head of someone who fits the definition of hubris for you. Hubris is really a thing for people in power. If you're a weak person and you don't have power over anyone, then hubris is just you in your own head. Hubris gets into trouble with people in power. And a psychology professor at Berkeley studied for 2 decades and discovered that power actually causes brain damage. People become more and more impulsive, less risk-averse, and less adept at seeing things from other people's point of view. This power mixed with an unhealthy ego is a recipe for disaster. The sexual harassment and sexual abuse issues now are really at their core about hubris. People in power objectifying, defining their own needs, not thinking at all about how it affects the person that they're perpetrating the act on. It's all about hubris. Conservative religious leaders who know what God really intends know what God thinks. That is the highest form of hubris, because you're using it to manipulate people that follow you, follow your religious perspective. But we could spend all day talking about examples of hubris, and I want to focus more on what I'm calling everyday hubris. And that's the hubris of you and me. When we're on the hubris side of this balancing act, we often are in a, I'm with it, I'm cool, I know what's going on. We have a narrow focus. We're not letting in that other, not opening the door to that ego room. Social psychology, which is a fairly new field, maybe 30 or 40 years old, has worked a lot with how we interact with the world, and they give us some ideas about our hubris toolkit. That's what I'm calling this. One of them has to do with what they call confirmation bias, which I think is part of why we make assumptions and why we stick with our assumptions. Confirmation bias is this tendency to seek out things and internalize things that fit with what we already think and what we already agree with. You can see how the road to hubris is paved with confirmation bias. Fundamental attrition error, another social psychology term, takes it a step further. Fundamental attrition error is where a behavior in yourself, you consider it about circumstances. A behavior in the others is about who they are as a person. And driving is the perfect example of that. Oh my gosh, I'm going too fast. Gosh, I'm in such a hurry, I have to slow down. Whoa, look at that jerk. Right? You assign a quality of person to the other, but you think of yourself as merely a victim of circumstances. You can see how the road to hubris is paved with things that we're very comfortable and familiar with. So how do we shift away from this lure, these natural tendencies of our nature? Well, often the world comes along and whacks us on the side of the head. This balancing act, particularly shifting out of hubris, is not without pain. I'm sure every single person here can tell me a story of where you felt humiliated. And probably that humiliation was because you were stuck in some idea of how you thought things were supposed to be, and the situation told you otherwise. This is this internal reconciliation we do. We get ahead of ourselves, or we get up so high on that high horse that it hurts like hell when we fall off. Mindfulness, of course, is the cure for hubris, paying attention, being present. Having people in your life who can call you on it is critical. But most importantly, managing hubris is about having a good, honest relationship with yourself. It's about making friends with yourself. And that brings me to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I want to tell you a little bit about the origins of this principle. They go back to the beginnings of Unitarianism in the United States and William Ellery Channing. Most of you have heard about Calvinism, which was the thought that humans were born depraved. Some of you may have learned that in church when you were younger. We were all born depraved, and we have to do things in order to, you know, either Jesus Christ saved us or God is going to decide whether we go to heaven or hell. Channing had a completely different perspective that transformed thinking about human nature. He said that each of us possesses the stamp of our Creator, that we have the likeness to God, and that we can evolve and change and become better as humans, as individuals, by recognizing that divinity within us and cultivating it through our experience and through the choices that we make. We have this divine possibility, and it's up to us to do something with it. So that's where our first principle comes from. We're not born in sin, but every person has inherent worth and dignity. You start with inherent worth and dignity, but it's about what you do with your life. Now, you use, or Unitarians, this is from our Unitarian heritage, have taken this idea of perfecting ourselves, likeness to God. Maybe sometimes we're a little obsessive about making sure that we're always getting better, a little bit too much into the working on ourselves, making ourselves as good as possible. The task is not about perfecting yourself. The task is recognizing and loving your wonderful, imperfect self. Sure, you've got that spark of divinity, but you're human. And so loving your wonderful, imperfect self is the task. Finding your own inherent worth and dignity. You know, our principles are only challenging if we think about living them. Right? If they're just words. So the inherent worth and dignity of every person in your heart, in your belief about yourself. This is what takes us out of the self-debasement side of this balancing act. Recognizing your own worth and your own value. If I had a magic wand or was visited by a genie who gave me one wish, my wish would be that everyone would feel their worth. Everyone would feel their worth. The challenge of this fulcrum of humility, of our debasement and thinking ourselves so fabulous, thinking ourselves not worthy, the challenge starts with having an honest and loving relationship with yourself. It's like Tai Chi for your soul, a balancing act for your soul. This is what we mean by resilience. It's a word that's come up a lot lately, resilience. It's what our world is calling for us. Our world is needing from us for us to be fully engaged. Resilience means a healthy ego that takes itself just seriously enough. Just seriously enough. Not too much and not too little. Loving yourself, having a good, honest relationship with yourself, and taking care not to walk down that road of hubris, that slippery slope. Finding the good and the bad in balance and loving your wonderful, imperfect, fabulous self in the process. Since the election last November, I've been thinking a lot about my call to ministry. What is my call to ministry in this world? How can I use my gifts to make a difference in this world, this chaotic, hurting world? I've been reflecting on that, and I've come to realize that my call to ministry at this time is to support you, to encourage you, to provoke you, to challenge you, and to love you into being the most vital, engaged, resilient person that you can be. To deepen our lives and be a force for healing in the world. Let's do this together.